dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has understood the war for the free world perhaps better than just about anybody, certainly done more to chronicle key aspects of it, what's at stake, how we've fared, what is needed in our time as well, is an historian of great renown and accomplishment, a man I consider to be a friend as well as a constant inspiration, a great guest, not often enough, I'm sorry to say, on this program, but we're always thrilled to have him, and never more so in the course of the 11 plus years of this program than today, when we're going to talk about perhaps his most important book of all, nearly 20 of them to his credit, on, as I say, fantastically important topics and always brilliantly documented, researched, written, and conveyed to the rest of us. But this book is perhaps his most important and the one that is so timely, it's almost providential, I think, that it is in our hands as we speak. The book is entitled The Devil and Karl Marx. Its author is Dr. Paul Kengor, a professor of political science and executive director of the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College. Dr. Kengor, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio and congratulations for this masterwork and for the timing of it as well. Marxism is once again enjoying an upsurge of romantic delusions on the part of large numbers of us. And we're going to talk about how that's come to pass. But before we do, Paul, I just wanted to set this stage, if I could, by asking you to just share with us some of your insights into the man who brought us Marxism, the man whose lasting impact on the world is almost impossible to fully calculate because it's been so malevolent and done so much harm to so many for so long. But tell us about the man himself and why it's hardly a surprise, really. What has been his greatest achievement, if I can call it that?
Sure. Yeah, well, he was born May 5th, 1818 in Trier, Germany, which is actually one of the most religious cities in all of Germany. Probably about 90% Roman Catholic. The Greek Cathedral of Trier is located there. It was built, financed, funded by none other than the great Saint Helena, who was mother to Constantine, who was the defender of Christians, the Roman emperor, who really helped enshrine and protect and launch Christianity in the West and worldwide. And Marx actually grew up quite literally in the shadow of that cathedral. His family was Jewish. They came from a long line of rabbis and even Orthodox rabbis. His father converted to Christianity, Lutheranism, about the time that Marx was probably about 2 years old. So we think this would have been about 1819, 1820. And the father, some historians say, did so under social pressures in those days from persecution of Jews by the surrounding community. I'm not sure to what extent that's true, but he did become a believer. He seemed to be somewhat of a Christian, at least believed in God. He wasn't an atheist. And his son, Karl, got baptized around the age of 5, so probably would have been around 1823, 1824. The mother held out on baptizing the children because the mother was more reticent about converting to Christianity. But he had this faith upbringing, eventually rejected the faith when he got to college. And, nothing new there, right? So how things have not changed. And he came under the influence of a professor of theology who was an atheist. You know, there again, how things haven't changed, right? Theology professor who was an atheist. A guy by the name of Bruno Bauer, who was also very anti-Semitic. And Carl became one of his favorite students. Bauer was like a mentor to Carl. And they even together launched what they call a journal called Archives of Atheism. That's what Marx was doing as a young man. And it eventually fell apart because they couldn't get a wealthy atheist socialist to fork up the dough to help subsidize it and prop it up. But they became together very aggressive atheists. There's a moment I talk about in the book where the two ride into one of the nearby villages at Easter time on donkeys, mocking the entrance of Christ into Jerusalem during the Passover. And that's the kind of thing that Mark did. And in a short time, he was writing some of his really nasty screeds against atheism. You know, the famous opiate of the mass essay. Yes, against religion. Yeah, the opiate of the masses essay, where he refers to religion as the heart of a heartless world, the soul of soulless conditions. And I talked too, he was not just heavily, you know, really against Christianity, but his statements about Judaism, Frank, shocking. You know, quote, "The Israelite faith is repulsive to me," unquote. And his statements about Jews, I mean, amazing. The man's ethnicity, he was Jewish. And his statements about Jews, Jewish people, Jewish faith are appalling. I mean, it's really nasty stuff. And he's been able to get away with it. Yeah.
So beyond the religion, talk a bit about his personal habits, as well as the early days of his radical ideological fulminations, of which, of course, anti-religious feeling was very much a part.
Yeah, and the personal habits I would include here as a segue, that he was very anti-black. He was very racist, and that had to do with his very strictly materialistic evolutionary worldview. Darwin was maybe his god, small g god. In fact, Engels even quoted Darwin in the eulogy at Marx's funeral. And Engels even gave the eulogy for Marx's wife at her funeral and again quoted Darwin. And Marx believed that human beings were not made in the image of God, but evolved from apes. And he believed that black people were much lower on the evolutionary scale than white people. You could find the N-word throughout his writings and Engels' writings. Some very racist stuff. Again, where's the cancel culture, Frank, right? I mean, where's haven't they come for Marx, right? You know, renamed John Wayne's airport. Something John Wayne said, maybe said. I don't know. I haven't even followed that one. I guarantee you whatever John Wayne said wasn't anything like what's in the writings of Karl Marx. I can assure you that.
We have to pause for just a second here. When we come back with Dr. Paul Kenger, we're going to talk a bit more about how this personal antipathy to both people of other religions and characteristics or of faith at all, and their institutions became the target of Karl Marx's determined efforts to tear everything down. That and much more with the author of The Devil and Karl Marx, Dr. Paul Kenger, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say, with Dr. Paul Kenger, the professor of political science who has been such an enormous influence, not only on his own students, but on generations of others through most especially his remarkable series of books, of which there are roughly 20 now, including several that are my personal favorites, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century, Dupes, How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century, and of course, The Judge, President Reagan's top hand, Judge William P. Clark. Paul, you've done such important work, but I think many of the other books are really prelude to this very important one that is just out now, The Devil and Karl Marx. And as we've been talking about, you've painted the picture of a man who was, well, a sociophobe, it sounds like, as well as, someone hostile to people of various faiths and so on. Tell us a little bit more about his personal hygiene and his attitudes towards his family, because this, I want to just give a picture of the personal qualities of a man whose nihilism obviously influenced his ideological musings and prescriptions and much of what flowed from them as well.
And that's the key point, Frank, right? The private became public, right? The personal became political, became ideological. And yeah, he was a slob. The man didn't bathe. He didn't groom. He was plagued quite literally by boils and carbuncles, which he had all over his private parts, all over his backside. And in fact, he could barely sleep. He would lay on his side. Doctors would come to the house, try to figure out what was wrong with him and why he uniquely had all these boils. And as Marx said to Engels, maybe the devil is throwing excrement at my head. Marx actually wrote that. And he was, they were at their worst, actually, the carbuncles, when he was writing Das Kapital. And he even said that after this, at least maybe the bourgeoisie will remember me for my carbuncles. But if you read Das Kapital, it's a miserable book. And people don't think enough about this, right? They just picture these kind of like written documents, like chiseled and whatever. But they're the product of people. And oftentimes, if it's this angry street, it's in part because this angry, miserable guy is writing it. And he was he wouldn't earn an income. Both his wife and his mother said, "Carl, would you please quit writing about capital and start earning some?" His wife really blamed him for the death of the youngest boy, Heinrich Guido, because of poor living conditions, couldn't keep a roof over the family's head. The money from Marx's parents had all run dry. Marx was bleeding Engels because Engels got all of his money from his wealthy capitalist father's inheritance, and Marx sucked as much of that as he could.
You've been speaking, of course, of Friedrich Engels in several of these references, his sort of collaborator in much of this malevolent communist, philosophizing and proselytizing. And so let's talk a little bit about what they came up with, Marx most especially, but with help from Engels, of course, financial and otherwise. The ideology that we now call Marxism is really, as you say, a direct product of this angry, hostile, and intolerant individual. So characterize, if you would, based on your research, both for this book, of course, and your other many, many chronicles of our time, what we have been bequeathed by Karl Marx.
Yeah. Yeah, they said they began the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels, with the line, "A specter is haunting Europe," right? The specter of communism. They said, all the powers of old Europe have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise the specter. Pope and Tsar, Metternich, French radicals, German police spies. So they knew, right? They described this as an actual specter. And the one word that probably jumps off of almost every page, it seems, of Marx's writings is the word abolish. Abolish private property. In fact, Marx and Engels write in the manifesto, the entire communist theory may be summed up in the single sentence, abolition of private property. Abolition of private property. I mean, right then and there, I mean, that's a biblical right. It's a natural right. It's a sacred right. I mean, thou shalt not steal implies that people have the right to property. They write, abolition. There's a line in there, quote, "abolition of the family," exclamation mark. Even the most radical flare up of this infamous proposal of the communists. He abolishes cities, societies, states. It's just kind of on and on and on. And what he doesn't want to abolish, he wants to criticize, right? He wrote in a letter to Arnold Rouge, he said, he called for, quote, "the ruthless criticism of all that exists," And I think particularly chilling, Frank, and this is a big part of this book, and Marx, who wrote poems and plays about the devil, he wanted to be the Goethe of his age. You know, Goethe wrote Faust, and you know, Faust includes the Faustian bargain with the devil character, Mephistopheles, the demon devil character. And Marx, as his biographers have noted, was particularly fond of a line from Mephistopheles, which is, quote, "Everything that exists deserves to perish. Everything that exists deserves to perish."
So hold that thought, Paul, because this really is so important to understanding not just what has happened in the years since Marx, but what is going on in our own time. I do want to ask you, though, about the history, what the practice of Marxism, whether it's under the guise of socialism or national socialism, or I would argue fascism or communism, there is a, well, I would say, unbroken record of dismal failure. It's not surprising given what you've said about the sort of impetus behind it, destroy everything. But what has come out of the application of Marxism throughout history?
I would say flat out despair, destruction, and death, which is replete in Marx's poetry, plays, and even in his family life. I mean, two of his daughters, Frank, committed suicide in suicide pacts with their husbands. I mean, you know, name another figure in the history of the world, right, who had two daughters who killed themselves in suicide pacts with their husbands. And Marx's poetry writes about suicide pacts. There's a chilling line in one of his poems, The Player, and I think this answers your question. He wrote, "Ever more boldly I play the dance of death." And I see communism as that, really this kind of grand dance of death. And that poem, he said, "Look now, my blood-dark sword shall stab unerringly within thy soul. The hellish vapors rise and fill the brain, till I go mad and my heart is utterly changed. See the sword, the prince of darkness sold it to me, for he beats the time and gives the signs. Ever more boldly I play the dance of death." And I almost thought of that, Frank, as a subtitle for the book, right? The Dance of Death, because, I mean, an ideology that killed over 100 million people in the 20th century alone, and is still causing despair, death, and destruction in Cuba and North Korea and China. I mean, you know, this was an unholy specter of communism, and I think it has had, you know, genuinely unholy results.
Well, unholy is one way of describing it, Paul. Let me just put a fine point on it. It really seems satanic. Not only that there's this admiration for the devil, Mephistopheles, Satan, whatever one wishes to call him, but that it is essentially doing the devil's handiwork. Soviet communism or other brands of it are just examples of that phenomenon, are they not?
Well, and there are many who have said that. In fact, people would be surprised to know the sources are as diverse as Alexander Yakovlev, who was Gorbachev's chief reformer, and he had the job of counting the skulls to try to figure out how many people died in the Soviet Union. He called it the flat-out demonic influence of communism, and in that, he's in agreement with the Roman Catholic Church, which in Divini Redemptoris, the encyclical 1937, called communism a satanic scourge, right, orchestrated by the sons of darkness. Pastor Richard Wurmbrand, who wrote a book called Marx and Satan in the 1980s. I talk about this book in my book. Wrote the book Tortured for Christ, and he was a Protestant pastor, I think probably Romanian Orthodox, maybe, I'm not sure. But you know, there are many who've dealt with this ideology and stared at it face to face who don't shy from that language, Frank. They use words like satanic. They really do.
It's certainly hard to argue with based on, as you say, the death and despair and destruction, which is so much at odds with what religion offers, with what civilization offers to people. And to the extent that there's been this practice, it's certainly been to the devil's liking, That's for sure. And when the Marxists are bent on such destruction, is there anything in particular that they are constructing in its place, or is it really just, you know, more horror?
Well, to an extent, it really is pure nihilism, right? And, you know, Marx was all about burning down the house, tearing down, and then kind of standing there in the embers, right, with his fist in the air. You know, and then, only then is he ready to build his new world. And I should add, there's a kind of a frightening letter that his father wrote to him not long before his father died, and March 2nd, 1837. And he wrote to him, he said, "Karl, that heart of yours, it is obviously animated." Now, this is a question. "And since that heart is obviously animated and governed by a demon, not granted to all men, is that demon heavenly or Faustian?" Heavenly or Faustian. So even the father, right?
Yes, indeed. We have to pause. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Paul Kenger about his new book, The Devil and Karl Marx, and the insights for our time that it offers. Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting for this full hour, I'm very excited to say, with Dr. Paul Kenger, the author of a new and extraordinarily important and timely book, The Devil and Karl Marx. We've been talking with him about the efforts he has undertaken in this book and his others, really, to know the enemy, something that is clearly needed if you're going to do something about the threat that that enemy poses. And I wanted to bring this up to the minute, if I could, Paul, by asking you about the, I believe, existential threat to freedom, as our much admired former leader Ronald Reagan used to say, of our time, namely the Chinese Communist Party. And what I guess it would argue is its practice of Marxism with Chinese characteristics. Has that made a dime's worth of difference, those Chinese characteristics, or is it basically of a piece with the other horror shows that you've just talked about?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think of what Madame Chiang Kai-shek told Fulton Sheen, 60, 70 years ago. She said that China will not have peace until China is Christian. And what's happened is that China has persecuted not just Christians but believers of all stripes. And to this day, where, you know, I got asked this question in class at Grove City College last week, Frank, by one of my students who said, "Professor, I don't get it. I mean, how could China be communist, Marxist, and yet have had all this economic success over the last 30 or 40 years?" And well, the truth is they've allowed enough market freedoms that it's hard to call them economically Marxist. What they really are is politically Marxist.
And also, they've simply had infusions of cash from us, which is a problem that we keep warning about. You can prop up a communist regime with endless amounts of somebody else's money, as Margaret Thatcher used to say.
That's right, which we didn't do with the Soviets, you know, especially under Ronald Reagan, where they did just the opposite, you know, sought economic warfare and to punish the Soviets. Yeah, well, at the same time, we were welcoming China as an ally, right, to counter the Soviet Union. So, yeah, indeed. I mean, we've been propping up China since 1979, or actually before that, with detente 1972, Nixon, the trip there, the Shanghai communique. So, yeah, it's a very good point.
But what we have, even if it's just at the political level, is something that is filled with the same sorts of death, destruction, and despair that you've described in these other communist systems, is it not?
That's right. Well, that's exactly right. And really, so you see here again, where regardless of how one would characterize China economically, right, they believe in Marxism, they believe in some degree of a mixed economy, whatever. The fact is, this is a one-party, communist party-controlled and led state. And, you know, that in itself, you know, that has redounded to this country of despair, destruction, and you know, so many of the problems that it has exported.
And that it has in mind for the rest of us, too, which is the exporting's only just begun. But between, you know, what they're doing to their own people and the threats that they pose to ours, this represents the most dangerous of all communist regimes.
And who knows with COVID, right? I mean, with COVID, I mean, you know, who knows the real story behind that? If it came from a lab in Wuhan, I don't know. I have no idea, right? If, you know, to what extent was it fabricated? Did, you know, who knows? But either way, it emanated from there.
Paul Kenger, your writings over the years have been very important, I think, in trying to awaken in the American people an understanding of these kinds of threats, one that is still largely unremarked and certainly not properly understood is the fact that we do have enemies inside our own country, and not a few of them, particularly at this moment, espouse Marxism and seek to bring about a revolution in this nation that would, I'm afraid, involve an awful lot of that same output, death, destruction, and despair, would it not?
Well, unfortunately, yeah, these groups have been around for quite a while. I mean, it's an occupational hazard of what I do, but every day, you know, Frank, I check the websites of Communist Party USA, cpusa.org, the Revolutionary Communist Party, which is run by Bob Avakian. They call him Chairman Bob. They go by the name RevCom, the Trotskyist Socialist Workers Party, People's World, Antifa, and all these different groups. Yeah, and I know you're alluding to this. I get asked about this in almost every interview now about Black Lives Matter and the founder, Patrice Cullors. And for the record, Patrice said of herself and Alicia Garza, the co-founder, she said, "We actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists." She says, "We are super versed on sort of ideological theories." And I have her memoirs, Frank. The foreword to her memoirs is written by Angela Davis, who's a mentor and inspiration to Cullors. Yeah, she's America's most famous female Marxist. She ran on the Communist Party USA presidential ticket as vice president twice. She won the Lenin Prize from the Soviet Union. But Patrice says, yeah, she said, quote, "We spent the year reading," this is an exact quote, "We spent the year reading anything from Marx to Lenin to Mao, learning all the types of global critical theory and campaigns across the world," unquote. And look, let me just say this. I get asked this all the time, Frank. So does this mean that BLM is a Marxist organization, right? Well, look, CPUSA is a Marxist organization. The Trotskyists is a Marxist organization. So, but BLM is running as an organization that's about, as they put it, abolish the police, violence against people of color and so forth. But the fact that the founders are telling you that those are their inspirations, those are important things to know about the founders, right? That cannot be disregarded.
But let me ask you about a couple of aspects of their agenda, which it certainly seems to me bear a striking resemblance to what you've been describing, coming from Marx himself, right on through its practice, his ideology's practice over the years. There is clearly a revolutionary quality to what they're talking about. Fundamental transformation is, of course, the Obama word for it, but that's pretty much what it amounts to. The destruction of families, which is not least part and parcel of, it seems, a lot of the LGBTQ overlay of this particular agenda. The elimination of the police, as you say, dispensing with the institution that preserves law and order. Going after other institutions, you know, the destruction of churches, the domination of the schools and what's being taught in them, particularly the government schools, the culture, the media, and even the government itself. And not least, what's come to light of late, Paul, but I'd ask you to talk about all of this, but particularly the seeming, you know, cultish qualities of this Black Lives Matter organization. Again, not all people who espouse Black Lives Mattering, but the organization under these trained Marxists. Give us a flavor of how this all fits into that basic template of Marxism.
And that's the really key point, right? I mean, 99% of people with a sign in their front yard for BLM are obviously not Marxists, right? And but like you said the word abolition, right? We're talking about abolition. That phrase, abolish the police, that's a really striking phrase. And I've written about this, and I thought, I mean, come on, you really mean reform the police, right? You don't actually mean abolish. But no, read the piece in the New York Times and say, no, we want to abolish the police. And, you know, where would you even get a word like abolish? Why would you use that word abolish, right? But there again, that word. And at the About section of the website, yeah, the About section of the website, it says that they quote, seek to disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure. I mean, gee, Frank, can we not criticize that even as we condemn the killing of George Floyd? I mean, I'm all for reforming the police, but I don't want to disrupt the Western prescribed and nuclear family structure. And again, Marx and Engels wrote in the Communist Manifesto, abolition of the family, exclamation mark, even the most radical flare-up of this infamous proposal of the communists, unquote. So those are things where, yeah, you could probably see the influence of the founders and those Marxist inspirations. And I would tell people, if you want to support that organization and you don't like that kind of stuff, well, then demand that the organization drop that kind of stuff, right?
And Paul, just talk, if you would, a little bit about this, well, increasingly bizarre manifestation of the, well, devil worship or calling up spirits for presumably their destructive power. I mean, where does this fit into the DNA of Marxism and help explain what we're confronting at the moment in terms of BLM's leadership, at least?
Yeah, that's brand new. I just saw that stuff in the last couple of weeks. And in fact, I should clarify here, Frank, and you know, in this book, The Devil and Karl Marx, I don't mention Black Lives Matter, Patrisse Cullors, even once. So, like you said, it's really ironic that I would have written this book and then it comes out when just this kind of stuff is coming out. So the spirits, the calling on spirits, the first email I got on that was from my friend the Reverend John Boyles, who was with the National Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. He was Ronald Reagan's pastor, and that's now out there and making the rounds, and I've tried to listen to the audio on that. I don't even know what to call it. I don't even know what to describe it. I would say this, it's clearly not of the Christian religion, right? At least they would say that it's not. It doesn't seem to be, you know, traditional religious belief.
Some have said it's voodoo or, you know, various strains of spirit worship and the like in African societies. But whatever it is, it does seem, the say their name bit in particular seems to have a somewhat demonic quality to it. And I think your help in establishing the pedigree going back to Marx is really important here, Paul Kengor. Hey, we've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more for Paul Kengor about, so what do we do about all of this? The critical issue of our time. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this very special, very timely conversation with the author of The Devil and Karl Marx. His name is Dr. Paul Kengor, a professor at Grove City College, and the author of numerous other books, but we're talking most especially about this one because of the urgent need to know the enemy, as Paul often argues, and to figure out what to do about its successful operations in our own country. Paul, we've talked a lot about the history of all of this and the applications of Marx's nihilism in our own time. Give us some encouraging words, if you can, about what we can do to counter all of these challenges, the cumulative effects of the march through our institutions and so on, especially in an environment when, you touched on this earlier, we are, it seems, being subjected to a sort of control control mechanism, as the communists would call it, in the form of COVID-19 and how we have to give up our freedoms. We mustn't speak critically or challenge the orthodoxies that are now being pushed forward by people who are, if not Marxists themselves, certainly aligned with a lot of the ambitions of the Marxists in our country.
Yeah, it's tough, Frank, when one side is saying, 100% or nothing, right? I mean, you have to accept every element of an organization, its founders, its inspirations, its agenda, with no room for criticism of items that are objectionable, right? Total commitment to the entire party line, word for word, or you're a hater who thinks that, fill in the blank, right? Black lives don't matter or whatever. It's really strange. So it's like we're stuck in this Twitter culture where you have to have like a 40-character position on something, right? There's no room for nuance and discussion and thoughtfulness. It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. This is where we are.
Well, it may be crazy or it may be purposeful that this really qualifies as political correctness, which of course is a technique for controlling thought as well as expression of it, right?
Well, and I know people on the left too who don't like this. I hear from them. They're afraid, right? They're afraid. They're afraid to speak out. I hear from the other universities, right? They're like, "Hey, listen, I'm a liberal, right? I'm planning on voting for Biden. I hate Trump, but I don't agree 100% of what these people are saying here. And I can't even dissent on, this." There's someone who will say, "I'm a liberal, and I actually have a family member who's a police officer. He hates this, and I can't even defend him publicly." People are fed up, Frank. I'll tell you. They've really had it.
You've studied this closely. You've had some personal experience with it, I think it's fair to say, in the recent past at Grove City College, of all places. The kind of success of these forces inside our institutions, notably, but not exclusively any longer, academia, to essentially silence those who disagree or cancel them, I guess is the term now. But what would you advise we as a people do to try to, take corrective action to restore our country, but also to contend with the efforts of those who are inside it trying to take it down?
Well, and interestingly, Frank, so I had that at Grove City College, having never even at that point written anything in my life about Black Lives Matter. Most recently, just last night, I got an email from there's a college in California that invited me to speak, and now they're looking at disinviting me because faculty members there don't like that I pointed out that some of the Marxist influences of Black Lives Matter founders, when in fact all I've done is respond to questions, right? interviewers. So you can't even answer a question accurately about what the founders themselves have said. It's just crazy. But all we can try to do is educate, teach, platforms like Secure Freedom Radio, what you do, you try to teach, make a better world. But I'll tell you, Frank, it's getting really hard. So many people are not just ideologically and intellectually aggressive, but I'd say intellectually lazy, right? They don't even want to kind of craft an argument or engage with somebody or dig a little deeper to find what somebody has written. They want to just grab something from whatever and use it to bar somebody. And what the left is doing is it's creating on universities in particular little ideological cocoons made up strictly of people who agree with them. And all this twaddle about their belief in diversity and tolerance and dialogue, they do not. They are banning anyone who disagrees with them, and they're creating out of what should be intellectual environments. They're creating places of no dissent, no tolerance, and no criticism and no dialogue. It's really a shame what they're doing.
It's worse than a shame because it has real practical effects. And I would argue, Paul Kinger, that what we're witnessing on the streets of America today is in part a product of this same practice, perhaps not as extreme as it is at the moment, but nonetheless, that kind of ideological indoctrination and intolerance that has brought us generations of Americans now who don't understand what this country is about, don't revere it, in fact, are inclined to be highly critical of it, if not abjectly hostile to it. And that's where we find the streets awash with people who are talking about revolution, or at least trying to bring it about. Paul Kanger, let me just ask you this, because faith is obviously a key piece of it. I know you're a devout Roman Catholic, but you understand what we're up against, especially in terms of this, not just atheistic, but deeply anti-religious ideology. What is the role of faith in our society if it is to be restored?
Well, it's a good question. And Marx said, communism begins where atheism begins. Lenin said, all worship of a divinity is a necrophilia. There is nothing more abominable than religion. Nikolai Bukharin, one of the early Bolsheviks who founded Pravda, said religion must be stopped by the tip of the bayonet. Communism and religion are incompatible. So the other side knows that. And with our faith, we have to go back to our faith. We have to defend our faith. But it's going to be hard to defend your faith against elements that want to attack your faith, that want to undermine it. And this is what, if people don't get this, if people don't understand this, if they don't realize how Marxists see faith as the enemy, the eternal enemy, I'm telling you, folks, this is going to blow up in your face. And you're going to end up in a point where they've already come for me. They've come for Frank. They're going to come for you next.
Paul, we're almost out of time, and I did have one last question, which it seems to me is really the one that ought to be what we leave our audience with, and that is, if we are to recover America from the clutches of now communists, democratic socialists, socialists, progressives, leftists, globalists for that matter, Marxists, whatever you want to call them, it does seem to me all of this has to be massively repudiated at the polls this fall. If there is to be, a chance for our country, as I say, to return to the qualities and the tenets and the freedoms that we cherish, but that are absolutely anathema to Karl Marx and his followers, no?
Well, that's right. And not to give an explicit endorsement for one side or the other, but from the Democrat ticket perspective, and you mentioned my Roman Catholic faith, Joe Biden is a lifelong Roman Catholic. And, if he's not stepping forward to defend his own faith and defend the faith against people hostile to it, I mean, that I could not support that. Right. He ought to be getting this. He ought to be understanding this. The man is almost 80 years old. He lived through the Cold War. He was in the Senate throughout the 1980s. At that time, he was somewhat, at least more of a fairly moderate Democrat. I'm considered voting for Judge Bork and Clarence Thomas, but, ultimately didn't. And that's a whole other story. Biden is somebody who should have really learned this stuff and should really get it. And if he's silent on this and doesn't get it, that's pretty sad.
Paul Kanger, we have to leave it at that. I appreciate so much all of your writings, but most especially this one, The Death and Karl Marx. I entreat you folks to go get it, read it, and pass it around, because it is an antidote, perhaps at least the beginning of recovering our country, something we must all be attending to with the utmost urgency. Paul Kanger, thank you again for joining us. Come back to us again soon, if you would, please. And in the meantime, keep up the great work you do at Grove City College. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.